Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Jordan Peterson, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and our topic is the psychology of terrorism. Jordan, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, I want to talk about the psychology of terrorism, certainly an important topic at this current time. And on your view, we really need to have a sense of the general psychology of all human beings, and then we can begin to talk about what's unique about the terrorist. So I'm wondering if you can begin by just giving us a snapshot, an overview of what your understanding of human psychology is, in particular how we react to anxiety, and then we'll look at the details of your view in the remainder of the interview.
Well, I got interested in the topic about 15 years ago because I was interested in problems associated with the Cold War and curious about why it was that people would arm themselves and fight to the death, especially the death of others, to protect their belief systems. So I started investigating the structure of belief systems in relationship to human psychology, and I found a couple of things that I think are really interesting. I think the one that's most relevant to your question is that for years and years and years, most psychologists have made the presupposition that human beings are by nature calm and that they learn to be afraid of things. Well, it looks like that particular presupposition is exactly backwards, and that we're naturally wired up so that anything new and unexpected, especially if it's of sufficient magnitude, automatically makes us wary and afraid. And that's because if anything new happens around you, you don't understand its significance. And if you don't understand the significance of something, it might be dangerous. And if it's dangerous, it's best to react automatically to it with caution. And the reason the automatic response with caution or fear is so necessary is because automatic responses are mediated by fewer neural connections, and that means they're much faster. So if something really unexpected happens around you, you get afraid really quickly, and that allows you to move into a defensive kind of posturing faster than you could if you were thinking about it. So one of the basic ideas that I've been working with is that human beings have a default-on anxiety system, and that anxiety system is brought under control in different situations as the person adapts to those situations and becomes comfortable there. Well, by the time we're adults, we're comfortable in almost all the situations that we encounter, although people will get nervous if they go to a new party, for example, and have to meet new people. But we maintain our control over anxiety using two methods, essentially. One is we tend to stay in territories, both concrete and abstract, that we're familiar and comfortable with. And the second is we tend not to encounter people or ideas that challenge the structure of the systems that help us regulate our anxiety. All right, so if you understand that people have default-on anxiety systems, and you understand that our learned beliefs help control that anxiety, then you get some instant insight into why it is that people are so upset if anything happens that challenges their systems of beliefs, because it disinhibits this terrible underlying anxiety system and makes people subject to their worst fears. So that's kind of an interview of the underlying idea.
Okay, yeah, that's very helpful. Let's look at each of those elements maybe in a little more detail. As I understand it, we are naturally anxious, naturally afraid, and the basic way in which we, at least one basic way in which we deal with that is we have a set of beliefs that help us simplify and understand and cope with the world.
Yeah, world, like at any given moment, wherever you happen to be, the world is so complex that you can't accurately map it. So what you do is you formulate simplified functional models of the world that enable you to act on it and to derive from that action those things that you need. Now, people don't aim at complete understanding, and that's because complete understanding of anything as complex as reality is always impossible. So we aim at a partial understanding that's sufficiently accurate to fulfill our needs. Now, if those partial understandings go astray somehow, then we're faced with the underlying problem of the complexity of the world again, and that makes us anxious.
Okay, so there's part of us, there's part of all of us that wants the certainty that belief systems can provide.
Yeah, well, I can give you a concrete example of that. I mean, part of the reason that people wear suits, say business suits, is because a business suit is a symbolic gesture pertaining to a particular set of shared values. Now, if you meet someone in a business suit, nice crisp shirt, nice tied up tie, all organized and efficient looking, you understand that this person that you're encountering, who you've never met before, has voluntarily or involuntarily adopted a set of values that allows you to predict his or her behavior. And that means that you can focus on the task at hand without having to undergo the multitude of complex cognitive operations that would otherwise enable you to understand the person. So uniforms and clothing that's associated, say, with a particular culture or cultural subgroup is a symbol of shared belief. And we wear those symbols externally, so to speak, to indicate to people who don't know us that we're playing the same game. And that makes us much, much simpler to understand and much less likely to provoke anxiety.
All right. What happens, though? I mean, one of the things that you said is that though that may help us cope with anxiety, the fact is the world does change. We face new circumstances. We do meet new people. And that provokes a certain amount of anxiety. I mean, what does happen, on your view, when we do face the unfamiliar, whether it be unfamiliar circumstances or unfamiliar people?
Yeah, well, we basically have two modes of primary adaptation to the unknown. And the one is tradition, and that can be long-term cultural traditions that you pick up in habit and belief as you mature, so that you become part of a given cultural subgroup or culture. And that's absolutely necessary because the world is so complex that you need the wisdom of your ancestors, so to speak, in order to orient yourself properly and in order to ensure that the people you interact with are existing in a harmonious group. So reliance on tradition is one primary aspect of adaptation to the unknown. Well, the problem with tradition, of course, is that it's always incomplete. The reason it's incomplete is because it's the sum total of the wisdom of the past. But the present keeps changing as the future is introduced to it. So the wisdom of the past is always only partially adapted to the conditions of the present, at least in terms of formal belief systems and action patterns. It's like trying to predict the stock market. I mean, you can only use a certain amount of wisdom derived from previous behavior to understand what's going to happen next. Well, human beings have evolved another mechanism to deal with the discrepancy between tradition and present reality. And that additional adaptive structure is it's actually a process. And that process is active exploration. Now, when something unknown happens or unexpected, I mentioned earlier that makes you anxious. Well, it's a little more complicated than that because people aren't only terrified of the unknown, they're also attracted by it. They like to boldly go where no man has gone before. While the unknown has this ambivalent nature, initially it's frightening as your mind responds to the potential danger. But after that initial fright, if nothing additionally terrible happens, curiosity comes forth, and that's under the control of a different neurological system. And that curiosity drives you into the unknown. And you can think of the unknown as a place of information because the world is so complex. Wherever you investigate, there's more information. When the unknown makes itself known, that's an indication that your current belief system is insufficient. And you have to explore the unknown to pull out the information that's embedded there to update your belief systems. Now, in mythology, all over the world, that's often symbolized as a dragon fight. The dragon's a good symbol of the unknown for various reasons, partly because it's got this reptilian aspect, and human beings, like most primates, are innately afraid of reptiles. The unknown's reptilian. Well, dragons also guard treasure. They hoard gold. Well, and that's an indication on a symbolic or narrative level that the thing that's terrifying, this fundamental complexity, is also an extremely useful source of value, knowledge. Well, this exploratory tendency that drives you into the unknown helps you investigate the structure of new things and to pull out new adaptive information from it. And in mythology, that's represented as the journey of the hero. The hero moves from a tradition that's damaged, courageously outwards, confronts the unknown, gathers the information that's buried in it, at some risk to himself, brings it back to the community, and heals it or transforms it. So human beings have two modes of adaptation to the unknown: tradition plus individual courage and exploration. Now, that heroic figure has some really interesting aspects, I think. This is essentially derived from, well, this was derived mostly from my studies of Judeo-Christianity. The hero has to be humble and brave and honest. Humble because unless you understand that the traditional values that already guide your actions are somehow incomplete, which means your knowledge is incomplete, there's no way you can explore and update your knowledge because you already know everything. You have to be brave because the unknown is frightening, and for real reasons. It's no game. The universe, the world, is a very complex place, and if you step out of line, it can kill you.
So all of us, I mean, what's common to all of us is we tend to feel anxious if something upsets our way of seeing and understanding the world.
Yes.
There are these two different ways that people tend to react to anxiety. And, of course, I'm sure there's some alternatives in between those two extremes. The question is, what determines whether someone is inclined to live simply by tradition, to refuse to be brave, humble, and honest, to use your just example, versus someone who's willing to be curious, someone who's willing to face their anxiety and to try to find out what they don't know before they go on and act?
I mean, part of it is this, like the third aspect of heroism that I had failed to discuss in my previous comment was honesty. And this is a strange kind of honesty because it doesn't really have anything to do with objective reality, but it's still absolutely real, and it has something much more to do with subjective or experienced reality. Like in any given situation, for example, in this conversation, both you and I have a particular end in mind. Now, hopefully it's the same end, which is the exchange of information, because then we can have a good conversation. Well, we set up this little system of desire, lay it out on the world, try to act towards it. So we're trying to have a good conversation. Well, you meet someone new, say you're trying to be interesting to them. And as you talk to them, you notice that their attention is drifting. Now, that's an error on your part, because your goal is to capture their interest. So if they start to drift, if you're honest about your approach to them, you have to modify your behavior so that you pull their attention back. Well, if you're honest, you admit to your mistakes, self-defined mistakes, right? Because you're the one who's laid out the plan. If the plan goes astray, it means there's something wrong with it. If there's something wrong with it, that means that the unknown has made itself manifest to interfere with your plan. So let's say you don't capture the interest of the person. That means there's something about them, in all their complexity, that you don't understand. And then you have to explore to find out what it is about the person that you're missing so that you can pull the plan back online. So if you're honest, you keep noting your mistakes. And if you're brave, then you'll move out into the unknown to try to correct them. And if you're humble, then you understand that you don't know everything and that it's necessary for you to be both brave and honest. Now, when I first started working through these problems, I got very, very depressed and pessimistic because I started to understand that people absolutely have to have a belief system. And if you disrupt their belief system, then you disinhibit the structure that controls their anxiety. And you can't do anything worse to someone than that, because there's virtually nothing that's more painful than terror. So people have to have belief systems. Well, then on the other hand, if they have to have belief systems, and there are belief systems everywhere in the world and they differ, then it looks like we're doomed to constant war. Well, I thought, that's great. On the one hand, you have disruption of belief systems and depression and a movement towards kind of a nihilism, but on the other hand, you have rigid belief systems and a movement towards war. Well, that's terrible. I thought, well, there's no way out of that, because you can't ask people to give up what they believe, and if they believe strongly, they're going to be aggressive and fight against other belief systems. Well, then I started to think about this hero motif, and the hero is the intermediary between belief systems, because he's brave enough to understand that he has a chance of being wrong and courageous enough to explore for something new. Okay, so then I thought, well, look at animals like chimpanzees or even wolves. Any animal that has a social hierarchy fights to protect its territory. But the thing that makes animals and human beings different in terms of their fighting to protect their territory is that animals aren't capable of the absolute atrocities that human beings are capable of. So, like, a wolf will kill an enemy or attempt to drive it off if it's violating it, the integrity of its pack, but it won't slowly torture it to death, or won't do the sorts of things that the Nazis did in the concentration camps to the Jews, where they would, for example, in Buchenwald, they had the Jewish prisoners who were starving pack 100-pound bags of wet salt from one side of the camp to the other and then back again, which is a kind of cruelty that goes beyond mere defense of belief. Well, I was trying to understand that. Like, how is it that someone could become motivated to move far beyond mere protection of their belief systems into this domain that's characterized by absolute malevolent cruelty, something that seemed completely unique to human beings? Well, then I started to understand that people who weren't honest with themselves started to build themselves a limited and compressed fortress of ideas. There's a medieval torture called the little room, and it's called the room of little ease, and you put a man in this room, and it's a foot shorter in all directions than he is. So there's no way he can stand up or lay down or extend his limbs at any point. It's a torture of compression. Well, people who become extremely rigid in their beliefs suffer from three particular errors. One is error of pride, and that's the same error that John Milton outlined as primarily characteristic of Satan in Paradise Lost. And the error of pride is the belief that the things you know are absolutely true and are never in any need of update. And that's not patriotism or positive regard for your tradition, because it puts you in the position where you believe that you are so intelligent and so perfect that your particular interpretation of your past or your culture's past is 100% accurate, and that you're a perfect exemplar of that tradition. Well, then the next error is cowardice, because everyone makes mistakes, and when you make a mistake, it's frightening, because it means that your belief system isn't accurate, and you have to be courageous to go and investigate why. Well, and you have to be honest, too, because otherwise you'll never admit that you made a mistake. Well, people who move towards viciousness in protection of their belief systems end up putting themselves in a structure that's like the room of little ease. They're too afraid to explore the unknown. They're too proud to admit that they're wrong. And they're too dishonest to notice that they've made a mistake. And that means that they have to rely more and more on this rigid, rigid tradition, and that they sacrifice that part of themselves that could boldly explore and expand their own beliefs. And this makes them tighter and tighter and more hopeless and meaner, and it's a vicious circle. It's a circle that Milton, again, described as leading to a psychological state that could only be, well, he could only describe it in terms of hell. And you could think of that hell as the same place that the Stalinists lived in Russia, where everyone was everyone else's enemy, and where everyone in the state was lying all the time, and where nobody could trust even another family member, and where the whole state machinery was gearing up not only to imprison and torture everybody who had any courage within the state, but to try to destroy the whole world. Well, the psychology of terrorism, that's belief rigidity combined with individual authoritarian pride, dishonesty, and lack of courage. And, you know, people talked about those guys who flew their planes into the New York Trade Center as being, you know, as being somehow brave because they were willing to put their lives on the line for their beliefs. They weren't brave. They're existential cowards of the highest order. They're so totalitarian in their beliefs and so cowardly with regards to the external world that they were willing to sacrifice themselves to bring misery to thousands and thousands of innocent people. There's not anything courageous about that. That's utterly despicable and cowardly. And it's a matter of personal morality, you know. Everyone has the capability to determine and to see that they're wrong. The evidence is laid out absolutely clearly and plainly before you. And if you're wrong and you're courageous, you can explore and find out what it is about yourself that makes you weak and unworthy. And people who hide inside their rigid totalitarian beliefs like a corrupt snail in a shell, there's absolutely nothing courageous about them. That's a complete misunderstanding of what human courage means.
So the model of hero that you're working with is in some sense very different than one that most people think of. I mean, when most people think of heroes, they think of individuals who are fighting to defend the truth. And in some sense, you're saying, no, what the real hero does is willingness to admit that they may well be in error, that they don't know everything they need to know.
Yeah,
and the heroism comes with trying to find out, to explore the new.
It took me a tremendous amount of time to understand. I could never figure out for years why there was such emphasis, especially in Christianity, but it's not unique to Christianity, on pride as the cardinal sin and humility as a primary religious virtue. But the humility, and there's also this notion in Judeo-Christian thought that humility is associated with courage. I thought, how do you understand that? Well, humility means I might be wrong. I might be wrong. And it's a prerequisite for learning. Now, this whole model is based on a view of the world that's very, very different from the current view that obtains. Like, our culture is very, very convinced that reality is materialistic. You know, at the bottom of everything, everything is made out of things. Well, I don't believe that anymore. I think that the world is made out of information. The universe is made out of information. It's laying around everywhere. There's way more of it than we can make use of. Well, if you have enough sense to understand that you're wrong constantly, especially when things don't lay themselves out the way you expected, there's the whole world is waiting there as a pool of information to be investigated. But if you think you're right, well, you haven't got a hope. You'll never find out where it is that you're insufficient. And to be human is to be insufficient. Like, we're always confronting a reality that's much more complex and informative than we can understand. Now, the hero is a figure who exists in representation everywhere in the world, and the story's always the same. And the reason it's always the same is because the pattern of the hero is the central adaptive pattern of mankind, and it's a process kind of truth rather than a structure sort of truth. And the process truth is that the best way to cope with the changing demands of a complex reality is to be dynamic and exploratory, as well as to be an exemplar of traditional wisdom. To balance both of those, it's a very difficult task. To understand your tradition well enough to embody it, and then to bring it forward into the future through courageous action. And that means individually courageous. It means standing up against the group when that becomes necessary, because the hero is frequently in mythology the person who restructures social order. That often makes him the enemy of the group.
Well, in the last 3 minutes of the show, I wonder if you could talk about how we might try to achieve that ourselves, and are there things that we can do to make it more likely that our culture is willing to be the hero?
Well, I think there are things that people can do. I mean, and I think the fundamental, you know, there's this line in the New Testament, Christ tells his followers never to pray in public, that the proper sort of prayer is private and personal. Well, the idea behind that is something like this. Like the great corruptions of the state, or the sort of corruption that we saw on September 11th, is the consequence of individual souls or psyches that have gone pathologically wrong. Well, how do you stop that from happening in yourself? Well, I think the first thing to strive for is a kind of clarity and honesty. I mean, look at your life, your interactions with the people around you, your family and your friends. I mean, you have to look carefully and see if those interactions are as clean and as clear and as direct and as courageous and honest as you can make them. And not to worry about issues that are beyond your immediate control. Often people are concerned about issues like that because they don't want to face the realities of their individual life. You know, Christ told people not to go pray in the temple until they had solved the problems that still existed between them and their brothers. Well, that's a good example. I mean, your relationship with your wife has to be honest and direct and courageous, and your relationship with your children and your attitude towards work. All of these decisions and processes that we involve ourselves with every day, those are important parts of reality. And if our relationship with any of those parts that seem trivial because of arrogance, if our relationship with any of those parts is corrupted, then we add to the possibility of the sort of thing that happened on September 11th. Like 15 years of study on this topic convinced me primarily of one thing. You know, there's another story in the Old Testament, Sodom and Gomorrah, where God is basically asked to preserve these terribly corrupt cities if only a few good men can be found. Well, the meaning of that story is fairly clear. That is that the fate of societies is dependent on the existence of good men. And that's the most fundamental political truth that there is. And if you're not a person who's striving to be good, I mean striving with all your heart, then you're adding to the possibility that these terrible events will unfold. And as we become more and more technologically powerful, we can less and less afford the danger that comes along with individual corruption. So it's an individual matter as far as I'm concerned. It's like... It's important for the survival of everything for people to come to terms with their own inadequacies and to try to live courageously and honestly and humbly as well. It's no game. This is the most important thing that can possibly be learned.
Okay, well, I hate to say it, we're out of time. I appreciate very much your appearing in the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for the invitation.
I've been speaking today with Jordan Peterson, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and our topic's been the psychology of terrorism. This is Hugh LaFalla, Fridays and Issues. Good day.